Climate Change the Facts. Cool It, an Essay on Climate Change by Nigel Lawson. Part 2. Pressing down on the alarm button. The 2013-14 IPCC assessment report does its best to ramp up the alarmism in a desperate and almost certainly vain attempt to scare the governments of the world into concluding a binding global decarbonization agreement at the crunch UN climate conference due to be held in Paris 2015. Yet a careful reading of the report shows that the evidence to justify the alarm simply isn't there. On health, for example, it lamely concludes that the worldwide burden of human ill health from climate change is relatively small compared with effects of other stressors and is not well quantified, adding that so far as tropical diseases, which preoccupied earlier IPCC reports, are concerned, quote, concerns over large increases in vector-borne diseases such as dengue as a result of rising temperatures are unfounded and unsupported by the scientific literature. Moreover, the IPCC conspicuously fails to take proper account of what is almost certainly far and away the most important dimension of the health issue, and that is, quite simply, that the biggest health risk in the world today, particularly, of course, in the developing world, is poverty. We use fossil fuels not because we love them or because we are enthralled to the multinational oil companies, but simply because they provide far and away the cheapest source of large-scale energy and will continue to do so, no doubt, not forever, but for the foreseeable future. And using the cheapest source of energy means achieving the fastest practicable rate of economic development, and thus the fastest elimination of poverty in the developing world. In a nutshell, and on balance, global warming is good for you. The IPCC does its best to contest this by claiming that warming is bad for food production. In its own words, quote, negative impacts of climate change on crop yields have been more common than positive impacts. But not only does it fail to acknowledge that the main negative impact on crop yields has been not climate change, but climate change policy, as farmland has been turned over to the production of biofuels rather than food crops, it also understates the net benefit for food production from the warming that it expects to occur in two distinct ways. In the first place, it explicitly takes no account of any future developments in bioengineering and genetic modification, which are likely to enable farmers to plant drought-resistant crops designed to thrive at warmer temperatures should these occur. Second, and equally important, it takes no account whatever of another effect of increased atmospheric CO2, and one which is more certain and better documented than the warming effect, namely the stimulus to plant growth, what the scientists call the fertilization effect. Over the past 30 years or so, the Earth has become observably greener, and this has even affected most parts of the Sahel. It is generally agreed that a major contributor to this has been the growth in atmospheric CO2 from the burning of fossil fuels. This should not come as a surprise. Biologists have always known that CO2 is essential for plant growth, and of course, without plants, there would be very little animal life and no human life on the planet. The climate alarmists have done their best to obscure this basic scientific truth by insisting on describing carbon emissions as, quote, pollution, which, whether or not they warm the planet, they most certainly are not, and deliberately mislabeling forms of energy which produce these emissions as, quote, dirty. In the same way, they like to label renewable energy as, quote, clean, seemingly oblivious to the fact that by far the largest source of renewable energy in the world today is biomass, and in particular the burning of dung, which is the major source of indoor pollution in the developing world and is reckoned to cause at least 1 million deaths a year. Compared with the likely benefits to both human health and food production from CO2-induced global warming, the possible disadvantages from, say, a slight increase in either the frequency or the intensity of extreme weather events is very small beer. It is, in fact, still uncertain whether there is any impact on extreme weather events as a result of warming. Increased carbon emissions, which have certainly occurred, cannot on their own affect the weather. It is only warming which might. The unusual persistence of heavy rainfall over the UK during February, which led to considerable flooding, is believed by the scientists to have been caused by the wayward behavior of the jet stream, And there is no credible scientific theory that links this behavior to the fact that the Earth's surface is some 0.8 degrees Celsius warmer than it was 150 years ago. That has not stopped some climate scientists, such as the publicity-hungry chief scientist at the UK Met Office, Dame Julia Slingo, from telling the media that it is likely that, quote, climate change, by which they mean warming, is partly to blame. Usually, however, the climate scientists take refuge in the weasel words that any topical, extreme weather event, whatever the extreme weather may be, whether the recent UK rainfall or last year's typhoon in the Philippines, is consistent with what we would expect from climate change. So what? It is also consistent with the theory that it is a punishment from the Almighty for our sins, the prevailing explanation of extreme weather events throughout most of human history. But that does not mean that there is the slightest truth in it. Indeed, it would be helpful if the climate scientist would tell us what weather pattern would not be consistent with the current climate orthodoxy. If they cannot do so, then we would do well to recall the important insight of Karl Popper, that any theory that is incapable of falsification cannot be considered scientific. Moreover, as the latest IPCC report makes clear, careful studies have shown that while extreme weather events such as floods, droughts, and tropical storms have always occurred, overall there has been no increase in either their frequency or their severity. That may, of course, be because there has so far been very little global warming indeed. The fear is the possible consequences of what is projected to lie ahead of us. And even in climate science, cause has to precede effect. It is impossible for future warming to affect events in the present. Of course, it doesn't seem like that, partly because of sensitivity to the climate change doctrine, and partly simply as a result of the explosion of global communications. We are far more aware of extreme weather events around the world than we used to be. And it is perfectly true that many more people are affected by extreme weather events than ever before. But that is simply because of the great growth in world population. There are many more people around. It is also true, as the insurance companies like to point out, that there has been a great increase in the damage caused by extreme weather events. But that is simply because, just as there are more people around, so is there more property around to be damaged. The fact remains that the most careful empirical studies show that, so far at least, there has been no perceptible increase, globally, in either the number or the severity of extreme weather events. And, as a happy coda, these studies also show that thanks to scientific and material progress, there has been a massive reduction worldwide in deaths from extreme weather events. The heavy cost of decarbonization. It is relevant to note at this point that there is an important distinction between science and scientists. I have the greatest respect for science, whose development has transformed the world for the better. But scientists are no better and no worse than anyone else. There are good scientists and there are bad scientists. Many scientists are outstanding people working long hours to produce important results. They must be frustrated that political activists then turn those results into propaganda. Yet they dare not speak out for fear of losing their funding. Indeed, a case can be made for the proposition that today's climate science establishment is betraying science itself. During the period justly known as the Enlightenment, science achieved the breakthroughs which have so benefited us all by rejecting the claims of authority, which at that time largely meant the authority of the Church, and adopting an overarching skepticism, insisting that our understanding of the external world must be based exclusively on observation and empirical experiment. Yet today, all too many climate scientists, in particular in the UK, come close to claiming that they need to be respected as the voice of authority on the subject, the very claim that was once the province of the Church. If I have been critical of the latest IPCC report, let me add that it is in many respects a significant improvement on its predecessors. It explicitly concedes, for example, that, quote, climate change may be beneficial for moderate climate change, and moderate climate change is all that it expects to see for the rest of the century, and that, quote, estimates for the aggregate economic impact of climate change are relatively small. For most economic sectors, the impact of climate change will be small relative to the impacts of other drivers. So much for the unique existential planetary threat. What if conspicuously fails to do? however, is to make any assessment of the unequivocally adverse economic impact of the decarbonization policy it continues to advocate, which, if implemented, would be far worse than any adverse impact from global warming. Even here, however, the new report concedes for the first time that the most important response to the threat of climate change must be how mankind has always responded throughout the ages, namely, intelligent adaptation. Indeed, the impacts section of their latest report is explicitly entitled Impacts, Adaptation, and Vulnerability. In previous IPCC reports, adaptation was scarcely referred to at all, and then only dismissively. This leads directly to the last of my four questions. To the extent that there is a problem, what should we calmly and rationally do about it? The answer is, or should be, a no-brainer. Adapt. I mentioned earlier that a resumption of global warming, should it occur, and of course it might, would bring both benefits and costs. The sensible course is clearly to pocket the benefits while seeking to minimize the costs. And that is all the more so since the costs, should they arise, will not be anything new. They will merely be the slight exacerbation of problems that have always afflicted mankind. Like the weather, for example. Whether we are talking about rainfall and flooding, or droughts for that matter, in the UK, or hurricanes and typhoons in the tropics, the weather has always varied, and it always will. There have always been extremes, and there always will be. That being so, it clearly makes sense to make ourselves more resilient and robust in the face of extreme weather events, whether or not there is a slight increase in the frequency or severity of such events. This means measures such as flood defenses and sea defenses, together with water storage to minimize the adverse effects of drought in the UK, and better storm warnings, the buildings of levees, and more robust construction in the tropics. The same is equally true in the field of health. Tropical diseases and malaria is frequently, if inaccurately, mentioned in this context, are a mortal menace in much of the developing world. It clearly makes sense to seek to eradicate these diseases, and in the case of malaria, which used to be endemic in Europe, we know perfectly well how to do it, whether or not warming might lead to an increase in the incidence of such diseases. And the same applies to all the other possible adverse consequences of global warming. Moreover, this makes sense whatever the cause of any future warming, whether it is man-made or natural. Happily, too, as economies grow and technology develops, our ability to adapt successfully to any problems which warming may bring steadily increases. Yet, astonishingly, this is not the course on which our leaders in the Western world generally, and the UK in particular, have embarked. They have decided that what we must do, at inordinate cost, is prevent the possibility, as they see it, of any further warming by abandoning the use of fossil fuels. Even if this were attainable, a big if, which I will discuss later, there is no way in which this could be remotely cost-effective. The cost to the world economy of moving from relatively cheap and reliable energy to much more expensive and much less reliable forms of energy, the so-called renewables, on which we had to rely before we were liberated by the fossil fuel-driven industrial revolution, far exceeds any conceivable benefit. It is true that the notorious Stern Review, widely promoted by a British prime minister with something of a messiah complex and an undoubted talent for public relations, sought to demonstrate the reverse and has become a bible for the economically illiterate. But Stern's dodgy economics have been comprehensively demolished by the most distinguished economists on both sides of the Atlantic. So much so, in fact, that Lord Stern himself had been driven to complain that it is all the fault of the integrated assessment models, which, and I quote him, quote, come close to assuming directly that the impacts and costs will be modest and close to excluding the possibility of catastrophic outcomes. I suggested earlier that these elaborate models are scarcely worth the computer code they are written in, and certainly the divergence between their predictions and empirical observations has become ever wider. Nevertheless, it is a bit rich for Stern now to complain about them when they remain the gospel of the climate science establishment in general and of the IPCC in particular. But Stern is right in this sense. Unless you assume that we may be heading for a CO2-induced planetary catastrophe, for which there is no scientific basis, a policy of decarbonization cannot possibly make sense. A similar, if slightly more sophisticated, case for current policies has been put forward by a distinctly better economist than Stern, Harvard's professor Martin Weitzman, in what he likes to call his, quote, dismal theorem. After demolishing Stern's cost-benefit analysis, he concludes that Stern is in fact right, but for the wrong reasons. According to Weitzman, this is an area where cost-benefit analysis does not apply. Climate science is highly uncertain, and a catastrophic outcome, which might even threaten the continuation of human life on this planet, cannot be entirely ruled out, however unlikely it may be. It is therefore incumbent on us to do whatever we can, regardless of cost, to prevent this. This is an extreme case of what is usually termed, quote, the precautionary principle. I have often thought that the most important use of the precautionary principle is against the precautionary principle itself, since it can all too readily lead to absurd policy prescriptions. In this case, a moment's reflection would remind us that there are a number of possible catastrophes, many of them less unlikely than that caused by runaway warming, and all of them capable of occurring considerably sooner than the catastrophe feared by Weitzman. And there is no way we can afford the cost of unlimited spending to reduce the likelihood of all of them. In particular, there is the risk that the Earth may enter a new ice age. This was the fear expressed by the well-known astronomer Sir Fred Hoyle in his book Ice, The Ultimate Human Catastrophe, and there are several climate scientists today, particularly in Russia, concerned about this. It would be difficult, to say the least, to devote unlimited sums to both cooling and warming the planet at the same time. At the end of the day, this comes down to judgment. Weitzman is clearly entitled to his, but I doubt it is widely shared. And if the public were aware that it was on this slender basis that the entire case for current policies rested, I would be surprised if they would have much support. Rightly so. But there is another problem. Unlike intelligent adaptation to any warming that might occur, which in any case will mean different things in different regions of the world, and which requires no global agreement, decarbonization can make no sense whatever in the absence of a global agreement, and there is no chance of any meaningful agreement being concluded. The very limited Kyoto Accord of 1997 has come to an end, and although there is the declared intention of concluding a much more ambitious successor, with a UN-sponsored conference in Paris 2015, at which it is planned that this should happen, nothing of any significance is remotely likely. And the reason is clear. For the developing world, the overriding priority is economic growth, improving the living standards of the people, which means, among other things, making full use of the cheapest available source of energy, fossil fuels. The position of China, the largest of all the developing countries and the world's biggest and fastest-growing emitter of CO2, is crucial. For very good reasons, there is no way that China is going to accept a binding limitation on its emissions. China has an overwhelmingly coal-based energy sector. Indeed, it has been building a new coal-fired power station at the rate of one a week. And although it is now rapidly developing its substantial indigenous shale gas resources, another fossil fuel, its renewable energy industry, both wind and solar, is essentially for export to the developed world. It is true that China is planning to reduce its so-called carbon intensity quite substantially by 2020. But there is a world of difference between the sensible objective of using fossil fuels more efficiently, which is what this means, and the foolish policy of abandoning fossil fuels, which it has no intention of doing. China's total carbon emissions are projected to carry on rising, and rising substantially, as its economy grows. This puts into perspective the UK's commitment under the Climate Change Act to near-total decarbonization. The UK accounts for less than 2% of global CO2 emissions. Indeed, its total CO2 emissions are less than the annual increase in China's. Never mind, says Lord Devon, chairman of the government-appointed Climate Change Committee, we are in the business of setting an example to the world. No doubt this sort of thing goes down well at meetings of the faithful and enables him and them to feel good, but there is little point in setting an example at great cost if no one is going to follow it. And around the world, governments are now gradually watering down or even abandoning their decarbonization ambitions. Indeed, it is even worse than that. Since the UK has abandoned the idea of having an energy policy in favor of having a decarbonization policy, there is a growing risk that, before very long, our generating capacity will be inadequate to meet our energy needs. If so, we shall be setting an example, all right, an example of what not to do. challenging the orthodoxy. So how is it that much of the Western world has succumbed to the self-harming collective madness that is climate change orthodoxy? It is difficult to escape the conclusion that climate change orthodoxy has in effect become a substitute religion, attended by all the intolerant zealotry that has so often marred religion in the past, and in some places still does so today. Throughout the Western world, the two creeds that used to vie for popular support, Christianity and the atheistic belief system of communism, are each clearly in decline. Yet people still feel the need both for the comfort and for the transcendent values that religion can provide. It is the quasi-religion of green alarmism and global salvationism, of which the climate change dogma is the prime example, which has filled the vacuum with reasoned questioning of its mantras regarded as little short of sacrilege. The parallel goes deeper. As I mentioned earlier, throughout the ages, the weather has been an important part of the religious narrative. In primitive societies, it was customary for extreme weather events to be explained as punishment from the gods for the sins of the people. And there is no shortage of this theme in the Bible either, particularly, but not exclusively, in the Old Testament. The contemporary version of this is that, as a result of heedless industrialization, within a framework of materialistic capitalism, we have directly, albeit not deliberately, perverted the weather, and will duly receive our comeuppance. There is another aspect, too, which may account for the appeal of this so-called explanation. Throughout the ages, something deep in man's psyche has made him receptive to apocalyptic warnings that the end of the world is nigh. And almost all of us, whether we like it or not, are imbued with feelings of guilt and a sense of sin. How much less uncomfortable it is, how much more convenient, to divert attention away from our individual sins and reasons to feel guilty, and to sublimate them in collective guilt and collective sin. Why does this matter? It matters, and matters a great deal, on two quite separate grounds. The first is that it has gone a long way towards ushering in a new age of unreason. It is a cruel irony that while it was science which, more than anything else, was able by its great achievements to establish the age of reason, it is all too many climate scientists and their hangers-on who have become the high priests of a new age of unreason. But what moves me most is that the policies invoked in its name are grossly immoral. We have, in the UK, devised the most blatant transfer of wealth from the poor to the rich. And I am slightly surprised that it is so strongly supported by those who consider themselves to be the tribunes of the people and politically on the left. I refer to our system of heavily subsidizing wealthy landlords to have wind farms on their land so that the poor can be supplied with one of the most expensive forms of electricity known to man. This is also, of course, inflicting increasing damage on the British economy to no useful purpose whatever. More serious morally, because it is on a much larger scale, is the perverse intergenerational transfer of wealth implied by orthodox climate change policies. It is not much in dispute that future generations, those yet unborn, will be wealthier than those alive today. Ourselves, our children, and for many of us, our grandchildren. This is the inevitable consequence of the projected economic growth, which, on a business-as-usual basis, drives the increased carbon emissions, which in turn determine the projected future warming. It is surely perverse that those alive today should be told that they must impoverish themselves by abandoning what is far and away the cheapest source of energy in order to ensure that those yet to be born, who will in any case be signally better off than they are, will be better off still by escaping the disadvantages of any warming that might occur. However, the greatest immorality of all concerns the masses in the developing world. It is excellent that, in so many parts of the developing world, the so-called emerging economies, economic growth is now firmly on the march, as they belatedly put in place the sort of economic policy framework that brought prosperity to the Western world. Inevitably, they already account for, and will increasingly account for, the lion's share of global carbon emissions. But despite their success, there are still hundreds of millions of people in these countries in dire poverty, suffering all the ills that this brings, in terms of malnutrition, preventable disease, and premature death. Asking these countries to abandon the cheapest available sources of energy is, at the very least, asking them to delay the conquest of malnutrition, to perpetuate the incidence of preventable disease, and to increase the numbers of premature deaths. Global warming orthodoxy is not merely irrational. It is wicked. Climate Change: The Facts is published by Stockade Books. All rights reserved.